Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we're going to be talking about technology and whether we understand and whether we're ready for the effects that technology is bringing upon us. There is a tsunami of stuff that's coming right now, and I don't think the average person realizes how much this is going to change our lives. So what I did is I brought on Alex Salklever. He is the head of marketing for Mozilla, and Mozilla is the one that owns the independent, the only independent browser on the market, Firefox, and he's going to talk to us about what he believes are some of the things we need to be thinking about with technology that we aren't. He lives in Silicon Valley, and he sees all the different things that are developing and coming forth, and it will blow your mind if you really knew all the different things that were going on, from mind manipulation to humans merging with technology at the mind level with, or even with bionic capabilities, and at the very tiny molecular level, the things that we're doing now with nanotechnology, the mini robots to fix things in your body, to do different things with material. You know, the driverless car is a famous one. And of course, there's a lot of ethical things that there is there. Then it gets into aging. We're right on the verge of solving our aging issues. We are already with the internet. Internet's amazing, right? We have a knowledge at our fingertips, but there's also other things that are changing. Basically, our societal infrastructure, our society's institutions are not keeping up with the changes that we're seeing in technology. The technology is way faster than our institutions can handle it. And so much of what we're seeing with the internet that happened, and you saw it with our last election, our social institutions just are not up to speed yet on where we are technology-wise and how it's changed society. And so we're just kind of grappling with how to manage all these things. And you think we've already had change? There is a more of a tsunami coming with all this stuff that is in the labs and that will be eventually here within the next 5, 10, 15 years hitting society and fundamentally changing the way life is on this planet. So I am going to bring on Alex Salklever. He is not speaking for Mozilla. He is here based on a book that he wrote called The Driverless Car, and he co-wrote it, and he'll explain that. So he's going to come on and talk about all about that. So let's get into that interview now. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on, Sarah. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, yeah. It should be really exciting to talk about what you have going on. First of all, why did you decide to write your book, The Driverless Car?
I wouldn't call it my book. I worked on it closely with Vivek Wadhwa. He's the lead author. I'm the co-author. I did a lot of the research and writing, and he provided overall guidance. And the reason that we wanted to write this is that we've been collaborators for a long time. We wrote a book together that actually was on The Economist's Book of the Year list back, I think it was in 2012. And we both live in Silicon Valley. We spend a lot of time here. And also we spend a lot of time thinking about new technologies and experiencing them in real world, in real life as we're walking around, as we're talking to people. I mean, we see Google cars all the time around Mountain View or on the freeways. And these days we see lots of other cars as well, too, from other driverless makers. And so over time, we just started to feel like all of these technology shifts were happening faster and faster and faster. And we felt a little out of control, not in a terrible way, but just in the way of like, okay, how do I think about all this stuff? How do I make sense of this? Because it's pouring in as news, it's pouring in as interesting things that are happening out in the world, in medicine, in education, in, you know, driverless cars, artificial intelligence. But these trends all will have incredibly profound impacts on the way we live our lives over the next decades and beyond. And we hadn't really seen anything that was designed to help people think about some of these trends and some of the harder questions that they might
And some of the ethical issues, right?
Exactly. Yes. So ethical is part of it. And also just, is it a good idea beyond ethics? And so that's why we started to think about this book. And it took quite a while to put it together. We actually started it about 4 years ago and went through maybe five iterations of it.
Well, how does your work at Mozilla, because aren't you doing more futuristic stuff? And what is your role there? And how did that play into how you saw kind of the whole world moving in a different direction?
So we started this book well before I came to Mozilla. I've been at Mozilla about a year. Mozilla does do really amazing futuristic work. We're one of the leaders in virtual reality on the web. So we actually, in our Firefox browser, we will be rolling out the first implementation, we believe, of virtual reality running in a web browser. So we think a lot about that aspect. And there's some of that in the book, too. And also we think about speech recognition. We have people thinking about AI. So this was a continuation of things that I'd been doing for 3 or 4 years before this, and almost a culmination in some ways. Here I'm the vice president of marketing communications, so I help us tell our stories to the world. But even before I came here and before we really got to the finish line on this book, all of the work that I've been doing has led into some of these questions and these thoughts. I mean, before this, I worked on cloud computing companies. I worked in advanced technologies to detect greenhouse gases, and I was a reporter. And I think all along this path, these questions lurked in the background, and they were things that I had been thinking about and talking to other people about, because very often with friends or with family or people who don't live in the Silicon Valley bubble, which is a sort of a particular and peculiar place, I was kind of an interpreter and a guide on a lot of these questions. Over the years, people have been asking me about all these. So I've had a chance to practice some of the answers. And this book was kind of all of those pieces coming together into one, I wouldn't call it concise, but one more directed effort to really share our thoughts.
So just to give people an idea, how do you see technology changing? And we're going to dive into each different area, but how do you fundamentally see it changing the world?
It's already changed the world in profound ways and changed even the way we think. I'll give you a super simple example. Most people I know today do not print out maps anymore, don't use printed maps. They use turn-by-turn directions on a smartphone. That would have been utterly impossible a decade ago, probably. I mean, yes, you could have bought the little things to sit in your car, and there were some implementations, but it didn't actually replace maps until really the last 2-3 years. So this also will change our brains as well, because map reading and skills around relating spatial directions into the real world, there's an actual brain manifestation, brain structure manifestation. So, we see these different things in technology that come into our lives, and they will impact the way we evolve, they'll impact the way we think, they'll impact potentially the way our bodies look over time, and also they will impact what our genes look like, in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Well, what do you mean by that? How will it change the way we look or what our genes will end up being?
So we actually believe, Vivek and I, that we're on the cusp of capabilities to radically edit the human genome. And I'm not saying we're in favor of this as a broad brush approach to...
Like with CRISPR-Cas9 and some of those technologies. Yep.
Right. When it becomes so easy to make those kinds of changes and to do it in a way that doesn't hurt people otherwise, then why wouldn't people start to make changes so that, a cleft lip, well, let's get rid of that gene, right?
So that's what you mean. You don't say that our body will evolve because of, or are you saying both things? Our body will evolve in certain ways and will reproduce in certain ways because of what we're using, versus we will manipulate our genome to be a certain way.
I actually think both. I believe that, and maybe this is a little crazy, but future humans, over time, they may look a little more hunched over because we're all walking around looking at our smartphones all the time. So I think I'm not a geneticist. I'm not going to make those kind of specific predictions. But I think that both editing the genes and our interactions with technology will change the way we look. And in some ways, that's already happening. I mean, Americans today, they tend to weigh quite a bit more than they used to, right? And that's most likely a manifestation to a degree of technology, because we used to be farm workers. You know, we used to...
There's a lot into that, too, because people think that the altering of our food source is causing obesity, and there's a lot of other issues with that, right?
So that may not be like the most clean example, but I mean, there probably are instances where the technology, you know, will change the way we look and or the way we you know, our bodies behave.
Well, I'm thinking with the map makers, we might not be able to see, understand the whole, visualize where we are as much, because we're just, a lot of people just take directions and not kind of see the big picture. Whereas, I mean, it might create more stratification, like we're already seeing, you know, the haves and have nots, people who can see kind of big picture and people who can't.
That might be one manifestation of it. I mean, I don't want to make big predictions, because realistically, it's very hard to predict the exact outcomes or what kinds of things will happen, you know, beyond 3-4 years out. And your body doesn't change on those kind of timescales. But I mean, we look at the history of evolution, you know, and people do change. They change because of the things around them, technology, you know, food supplies, all sorts of stuff.
Could change our culture pretty quickly.
It could.
And how society is set up. So why do you think individual choice matters so much in where we're going?
So choice is something that's it's one of those things that, you know, you don't really recognize it until you don't have it anymore. You know, it's when it's gone, it's horrible. And so we feel like that this is something which people need to exercise that muscle better. And in particular now, because if we want to understand a lot of things that are happening to us or the way technologies are impacting us, you know, we will need to both understand them and potentially make a choice about whether we want to interact with them or how we feel about them or whether we think that this is a good idea, both at an individual level or at a societal level.
Well, so people can understand let's start with AI. You think AI may be the scariest area, but also exciting and amazing. Can you talk about AI a bit, and why is it exciting and why is it potentially very scary?
Sure. And also, just before we go on, I wanted to just make one thing clear. So in all these conversations, I'm not representing Mozilla at all. These are my personal views. I just wanted to make sure I separated that, because it's, you know, it's my book. And
sure, no, that's fine. I just wanted to relate some of your experience that it would come in. But the other thing is, Elon Musk just did a big article in Vanity Fair, and he's coming out. He just purchased a company that's going to integrate your brain with computing and things. So he's scared. I mean, he was talking about how this is really something we need to be looking at, and he wants to put kind of the brakes on with ethics and things. And so you're right down the same path that a lot of people are talking about. But for you, you say it's exciting, but it's also scary. So why is it exciting and why is it scary? And why are people coming forward and saying, hey, wait a minute, we need to look at this seriously?
Yeah. So the exciting parts are that it's advancing really quickly and starting to be able to do things that we never imagined it could do before. You know, a really good example of this is you're probably familiar of I think it's Google DeepMind is the artificial intelligence system that they use to program to play the game Go, and it actually beat a world champion at the game Go. What was particularly interesting about that is that in that game, or in some of the games, the system, it displayed what we would call emergent behavior, meaning that it made moves which, when the human Go masters looked at it, said, I don't really understand that move. And it wasn't obvious, and it wasn't something that was programmed in them, because, you know, the way that they programmed that machine wasn't giving it a list of moves. They let it learn from watching Go masters play. And so the system created something unique and different and emergent. And that's where you start to see things that are, you know, that's what's kind of different now.
I think that's kind of cool because it could help us evolve as humans if we take it right.
It's incredibly cool. And I mean, and that lets the machines, if everything goes the way we hope, start to do things, come up with new strategies, think of new ways to attack problems. Now, granted, this is a very specific subset. This is a machine designed to play Go. It's not a general intelligence machine. It couldn't, you know, figure out how to tell you, how to advise your child where to go to college
sure.
or something like that. And that's, I think, more Elon Musk's fear, is that when we cross this threshold where general intelligence AI becomes as strong or as good or human intelligence, because technology improves faster than our brains for obvious reasons, you know, then the worry is, how do we control the machines, or will the machines control us, or will they take us down a path where they design a world to be for the machines and not for us? And that's sort of the scary part.
Well, and I think people need to understand that there isn't consciousness with machines. So at least at this point, and I, you know, having the machine do it for themselves versus us, and being us not being able to control it, that will really won't happen until we merge our brains with the machines and we kind of screw ourselves up, right? Because while we can still control the machines, they can't take over.
They're
not conscious, right?
That basically, yes. The idea, though, is when we get to general intelligence, potentially they could arrive at some sort of consciousness. We don't really know. Or there could be ways that we program them that maybe inadvertently we don't realize how destructive it could be.
Well, that's true. I don't understand how a machine can go to consciousness unless we start using biological machines and things like that, which we are starting to do.
Yeah. And that's much more a question for sort of the ethicists. And that's you know, quite a long ways out.
Sure, exactly.
But at the same time, it's a super interesting question, because even now you look at biological models and, you know, we don't fully understand consciousness even now. So you know, that doesn't mean that machines can't have it for sure. You know, so I mean, I'm not saying that it will or won't happen, but it's a complicated discussion. It becomes more complicated as the machines start to be able to do tasks much better than humans, which are closer to general intelligence.
Sure. Okay, so what is the biggest fear? Like, if we attach, I imagine that if we plug ourselves into the internet, the cloud, and different things, that we might lose ourselves, like our sanity, or we might start messing around with other people's brains if we could get inside their brain as well. And we suddenly, the risk of people being able to spy on us becomes that much more. And they're starting to learn how to manipulate our brains. You know, so if we're plugged in and they can send us signals and tell us what to feed our brain, suddenly we might be just doing what people are telling us to do.
And that's why we talk about choice so much, because we have to make sure that we cement ways that we as individuals have control over the system, have the choices to opt out, have the choice not to participate, or the choice to pull the plug. And it hasn't been like that entirely to date. I'll give you a quick example of that. And granted, we have a choice to participate or not, but a lot of what's happening online right now, you know, when we travel around the internet, unless we're pretty vigilant, people can track us, people can see what we're interested in doing, people can see what we're searching on, people can see what we're clicking on. And it's not so easy to clean that up. There's no one place where you go to clean up your internet history, you know. And so the internet, people's activity on the internet is kind of a window into their soul, right? So how do we take those kinds of activities where really the machines potentially could have a window into our soul and preserve our choice and our privacy in that situation? And it becomes harder and harder, as you say, once the interface between the brain and the machines becomes more tightly integrated. I mean, right now, it's actually kind of shocking, if you think about it, how much we rely on technology as an extension of our brain. I mean, Google is basically an extension of your brain, or, you know, whatever search engine, the things you're doing online, you know. Because in the past, you had to go to a library and look that information up, or you had to store it in a book or something like that. Now you search for it online. So a whole class of activities have changed and become our brain extending into the internet. When that becomes a hardwired situation, then it becomes a lot more, tricky to think about and police. And that may never happen. You know, we don't know. Elon Musk's, his proposals are pretty out there. I'm not saying that they're horrible. I can understand the idea behind them. But, you know, that future may never come to pass. That being said, pieces of it are here already. So like pacemakers, for example, are programmable. Often they carry wire, or they, in the past, they've carried wireless capabilities. So there was real concern when, Vice President Cheney had a pacemaker about how programmable that pacemaker was by people who were not, in his body.
Well, they've done research at Stanford with mice where they've actually been able to take and implant the directions of a maze, they've never had, kind of like the Matrix where you download your ability to fly an airplane, but they did it with a mouse being able to go through a maze. So they've been able to do really fundamental, basic stuff with mice on teaching them how to do something simple. So they know that you can, like, let's say you want to plant in somebody that this is a scary place, or go to this mall, or go, you could really direct people, or you could really affect things. The propaganda that's going on now is nothing compared to what they really could do.
That's true. If the situation is allowed to evolve where there is no regulation, there's no choice, and people's individual rights are ignored. You're absolutely right that the scientists are starting to do pretty remarkable things with direct interfaces with the brain. I mean, similarly, with magnetic resonance imaging machines, you can look at what people's brains are doing and actually see the words and their thoughts forming. It is translatable. There isn't much left that shields our inner selves from that. Now, that said, like with the mice, how cool would it be if you're going to Germany, you get a German language implant for your week trip, right?
Yeah, I know. There's some positives to this, too. I'd love to be able to download a software or the information to be able to fly a plane like in the Matrix. He sits there all day and just downloads information. He can't get enough. I mean, I could relate to that.
Very much so. And a lot of these things that are so hard for us to do, like play a violin, learn to hit a 90-mile-an-hour fastball. There's physical manifestations to it, but the hard work is really done in the brain circuitry.
Well, they kind of know that your muscles have to, there's learning muscles, and there's, when you're learning how to play a violin, you have, when you get to a point where you don't even have to think about it anymore, it's because your muscles are actually learning too. There's brain memory or something in muscles. It's interesting.
It's true, but it's the nerves that are driving the muscles. A big part of that is the brain muscle connection. You've done this so many times that your brain knows how to do it without even thinking about it. And you've probably done this, like probably when you drive home from work every
day.
That's
when you get in accidents.
Yeah. Sometimes,
because you're not thinking about it and something different happens.
Exactly. Yeah. But you don't need to think about it unless something different happens in that case.
So this is where ethics really comes in. Whether you want to look at individual rights or whether you think what's good for society as a whole is the way to go. Because if we don't get to more of an individual rights look at ethics, we could be looking at some pretty scary things. Because if we look at utilitarianism and we take that direction, we could get to a really scary future.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I don't want to paint it too darkly.
If we don't look at individual rights and look at it from a different perspective. Like if all the decisions are made for the general good, then, ultimately the general good is the most important. But if you're looking at the general good, you could be making decisions that gets us to the point where it's not about the general good. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. And this goes back to de Tocqueville and, tyranny of the majority. And, this was a consideration the founding fathers had on, how do we balance individual rights versus the needs of society? And sometimes it's like a little bit of an easier choice. I mean, for example, in driverless cars, I think ultimately it will be a very easy choice, because the benefits of having the robots drive the cars are so great compared to people that I think ultimately very few people will drive cars.
Well, and there might be a law, right, that you can't drive it in public in certain places, like that
exactly.
Only the robot will be able to drive.
Right, or you'll be able to drive it on the racetrack for fun, or you'll have to pay an insanely high insurance premium and have like a robot backup unit in your car or something like that.
Yes.
But in that case, like you look at the societal benefits of the technology versus the individual, and it's like so tremendously obvious that this is something that should happen. Just by, robots don't get drunk, they don't get tired, they don't try to text, they don't get blinded by the sun, at least not to the same degree. On the other hand, we have other types of technologies around, say, editing the human genome, and should we allow athletes to edit their genomes to improve their performance? Should we allow parents to tune their kids, in vitro for intelligence?
Well, and I think even the scarier part is we just learned, I talked to the scientist whose lab found this, that CRISPR-Cas9 is cutting in many, many, many locations, that secondary locations that they didn't realize. And so the problem is, until we really have our act together, you can alter the genome in ways we don't even know. And so there's no restrictions on working with human embryos in other countries.
No, and in China, they're actually doing quite a bit of this now. Although it's, for the most part, the scientists are being pretty cautious. They're doing it with this with non-vital embryos. Very rarely.
But how do we control the Dr. Stranges of the world?
You can't, ultimately. Not when you have dog breeders using CRISPR to, do genetic editing of their Rottweilers to produce better Rottweilers, this is actually starting to happen. You're starting to have DIY gene editing.
Or put a little bit of wolf gene into their Rottweilers that will make them strong in certain ways. Crossbreeding and all sorts of stuff. And at the same time, they're not worrying about animals as much. And so when they're using CRISPR-Cas9 that has all these all different places that it's cutting, these secondary cuts, what's going on to the animals' genomes?
And that's an area where I think both Vivek and I agree that we should proceed very cautiously and understand the technology better, not rush into this headlong because it's so promising, because the side effects of messing with these things could be long-term and profound. I mean, and I think that's why you see people even taking pause for permanently altering genomes of things that are really generally bad for people, like the genomes of mosquitoes, that transmit malaria, or the genomes of ticks that transmit Lyme disease. Even though those are the kind of things, they're not warm and fuzzy, right? They're not like a dog you're trying to make a perfect breed. These are things that are bad for people. But at the same time, altering the chain of nature and changing the way genes are in the wild permanently could have long-term effects that we don't understand.
But you know what's great is the scientists that are actually trying to help humanity and working on getting rid of, deer ticks giving Lyme disease or mosquitoes doing bad things, those are very usually pretty ethical people. They're not going to devote their life to helping mankind without having an ethical base. But the people that are trying to breed dogs so they can make a heck of a lot more money or win at all costs and those kinds of things, they don't have the same ethical restraints that somebody who's trying to, help humanity would have. And that's where it gets scary.
That's true. And I'm also somewhat confident, though, that there will emerge some technology solutions for that. So as an example, some of the folks at Harvard who are some of the CRISPR-Cas9 folks, you may have interviewed some of them, they're working on ways that they can bake into gene drives, and that's what we're talking about with the mosquitoes and the deer ticks, of sort of in a generation or two permanently altering a genome of an animal or a bacteria so that it becomes less harmful. They're looking at building in mechanisms that can reverse those drives,
that can revert
an ecosystem back. So I mean, as we start to look at these mitigation measures, the scientists understand the same problems, the problems even more than we do. They know.
Yeah, they're like, we need, just like in computing and the worlds of high tech, we need the way to have a backup version when we mess up.
Very much so. Yeah. And so, I mean, I'm actually fairly confident that there will exist some viable ways to combat the problems that we might see around, that might emerge from unethical people trying to use these technologies in ways that we don't want or hadn't predicted.
So how do you see education changing? Because I think this is one of the biggest factors that could change the world, is, and people might not see it, it might not seem really glamorous, but fundamentally changing education where children can get stellar education no matter where they are in the world or where they are on a economic scale will fundamentally change the world. How do you see that changing?
So that's one of my fondest hopes and wishes. And Vivek and I both have thought about that and looked at it quite a bit. A couple trends are converging, which we hope will lead to much greater educational outcomes and opportunities for all children everywhere on earth and grownups too. I mean, because everybody wants to learn. You keep learning. That's
oh,
what
absolutely.
You do. I mean,
actually, you so like to learn more the older you get sometimes, right? Or
absolutely.
In your middle age here, I just can't get enough.
I mean, if I had my druthers, I'd go back to school and probably try to learn 10 languages and not have to worry about paying the mortgage. But I mean, you know, and I think a lot of people feel that way. A lot of people would love to spend a lot more time learning. So what's changing is a couple of things. First of all, you know, everybody has a smartphone. This is pretty new. I mean, 5, 6, 7 years ago, not everyone had a smartphone. And the smartphones are rapidly becoming the equivalent of a supercomputer in your pocket. You know, you look at the smartphones today and they were the stronger than the computers that we were using to put men on the moon back in the 60s. Far stronger. And it's only getting more so. Similar, and it's another factor is connectivity is getting better and better and faster and faster. So the things you can access from the web or online to put onto your smartphone there, it's happening so that you can get much faster throughput, and that makes for easier ways for you to have rich environments on your phone. You're not just a prisoner of the computing power of your phone. You have access to the entire world of computing power and all the experiences that are out there in the world. And sort of the last piece of this is the AI stuff, which we've talked about. And, you know, when you look at a lot of learning, there's two key components of it. I mean, one of them is really strong repetition and reinforcing what you've learned. You know, it doesn't have to feel like rote learning. You can make it fun in games or other ways. But really, you know, you sort of do need that kind of reinforcement. And another piece of this that's sort of a critical piece of teaching is essentially coaching, right? You know, is having teachers that can help you work through difficult problems, help you reframe questions and understand them. I feel like we're on the cusp of having the computers take over the first part. You know, where, for example, if you wanted to run Spanish tests, you know, to better learn Spanish language, computers are spectacularly suited to give you feedback on that. You know, you can run flashcards and have the computer surface the flashcards that you miss the most, or correct your pronunciation if your pronunciation is slightly off. You know, and it can recognize you as a student and give you this type of reinforcement and feedback that will really help you learn without necessarily sitting in a classroom waiting for the next person to, you know, to put their hand in the air, or if someone's misbehaving, it gets in the way. No, none of that's in the way. You know, and this is what we call the flipped classroom model. As you move further along with this too, and as AI gets a bit better, then you can have the computer start to do things around, say, teaching people how to write with better style and grammar. You know, these are still systems. Don't get me wrong. This isn't like the most amazing creative type of activities. It's just teaching these knowledge transfers that in the past have been really difficult and cumbersome through humans as a broadcast mechanism. And variable, because not every teacher is a good broadcaster, right? Teachers can be great coaches and bad broadcasters. When I say broadcaster, I mean someone that can stand in front of the classroom and keep everyone engaged, showing them information. So over time, and we're already seeing this in a lot of schools, the technology, I believe, will start to take over that part of it, and the teachers will start to do the coaching. Because of the platforms we're looking at, the teachers won't have to sit with you. The teachers can be anywhere in the world. And we do see some of this already where for example, I believe grandmothers in the UK volunteer to help kids in India learn math, for example, and they do it over Skype. You know, so we don't need necessarily to have people trapped in a physical classroom to have them access great resources and technology. And that changes the entire game, because really, even to date, school more than anything is a physical place you go as opposed to a way of learning. I don't want to belittle educators either.
Well, no, but with hyper-realistic holograms, you could have the teacher there right in front of you teaching things without it feeling like you're looking through a computer.
and the hyper-realistic holograms where you can't tell really that it's not real is here. So
yeah, absolutely.
You could have that as your teacher, and so that could be all over. You could have the best broadcaster, for example, doing, you know, 15-minute little lectures here and there to people all over the world. And then you have coaches that are doing the other stuff. And then you have computers doing it. I mean, it could be all mixed in.
Yes. And so, I mean, all of this stuff is possible and it's wonderful. Now, that being said, the first pass at trying to make this work with some of the MOOCs, you know, the massively online, you know, the courses like Coursera, where you could have potentially tens of thousands of people taking a course through videos and doing tests online, they didn't all work so well. And a lot of them tended to bias towards people that already had the best educations.
Well, that doesn't mean that it's not going to work in the future. It's another example of how we don't know what we're doing yet.
Correct. And so, I mean, we haven't figured this out perfectly yet. Removing all human interaction probably will be a bad idea, because there is something to interpersonal, I mean, being in the room with people, with peers, that's really special and probably helps motivate and connect people to education.
Well, there's a connection between humans that we don't understand either. There's an electrical exchange that takes place, and some of the learning might happen subconsciously. I know that sounds weird, but government has done, I just did a show this week, government has been doing a lot of secret research in this area. They know that there's a connection between people. And so we don't understand that yet either.
Exactly. And so this education in the future, it shouldn't be someone sitting in their apartment with their VR goggles on, just, you know, essentially learning stuff through holograms and online interactions. It doesn't have to be trapped into that just that space, but it can help us blend the two, the real world and the virtual world, to give people resources and courses and capabilities they never would have had, in particular in parts of the world where teachers are an incredible luxury, schools are not good, and there's just not enough money.
Well, and if we use it properly, they'll get more of that, but we could also get more interaction, right? Because people need the interaction to be more human. They've known that when we don't have the interaction, we become, you know, in ethics, it's called psychological distance, and that we can do things that aren't all that great. And so we need that human interaction, but yet it could also bring us both, you know, but that's where you're talking about your choices.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So, I mean, the choices there is sort of, how do we structure the educational system going forward? And also, how do we control the data of how we're learning? I mean, who owns that data? You know, how does your brain work? Because that's what an educational system, a good educational system, will understand. It will understand your learning profile. It will understand your preferences. It will understand how to interact with you. It'll probably understand what time of day you get tired. You know, what times of day are the best time for you to learn.
People don't learn this. Some people need to do to learn. And then be, you know, like, you might have to do it first and then sit and listen to a presentation, or, you know, sit and listen to someone talk, or somebody might need to listen to someone talk, then do, and then do a lot. And then, you know what I mean? Different people.
Oh, yeah. There's very different learning styles. I mean, that being said, there aren't so many different learning styles that we probably couldn't figure out.
Yes.
A few thousand of them, say, they would encapsulate 95 or 99% of the world.
Yes, they already know the majority of them right now.
Exactly, yeah. And so they'll just be sort of little flavors on these. And so, but at the same time, this kind of personalization of education, I think, will be in the future. And I think it's, you know, we'll see it in lots of other places. In medicine as well, it's another area.
Let's talk about medicine. What's going on there?
We're at an interesting point now where we're not seeing personalized medicine yet, but we're getting really close.
Mm-hmm. And in certain areas, we're doing it, like with dieting or something, that they know there's a big market for it.
Very much so, yeah. And that's, I think, actually an area where there's still the most room, of all things we talk about in the book, for trying to figure out what's really going on. Because very recently, a whole new level of a new factor was injected into the equation that we didn't really think about before, the microbiome, sort of our interactions with bacteria in our stomach.
Oh, yeah. It has a lot more to do with what we're doing.
Exactly. So, I mean, that kind of threw everybody for a loop, because it made people start to realize that, oh, this is actually a more complex system than we thought. And they had inklings of it. I mean, if you go back to early.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but that's what a perfect example of where we don't know what we're doing. We think we're totally got it figured out, and then we don't know what we're doing. And when we alter foods and stuff to kill bacteria, next thing you know, we're killing the bacteria in our own gut. And because our gut bacteria is such a part of our ecosystem, we're messing up our own bodies. And we're like, oh, we didn't know what we're doing. Until we really mess ourselves up, we didn't know what we're doing. That's the crux of the danger. But anyways, keep going. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you.
That's very true. And so I don't think we'll ever get to a place where we will completely understand all of these systems 100%. And even and that maybe the computers to a larger degree, although even there, for example, the way that they're building artificial intelligence system now is with something called deep learning, you know, which is a very parallel way of letting computers look at a problem, look at how other people solve a problem, and look at it enough times and then figure out their own ways to solve the problems. And then it starts writing its own code, and literally the engineers do not know what the code means. They're looking at now creating visualization tools that will help them understand what code computers write for themselves to solve problems that we have told them to solve. So, I mean, I think very often as we get to this level of systems complexity, it becomes really hard for us to know 100% of things. But if we can get to a point where, you know, for certain types of things, we have a very good idea and we've minimized the risks in medicine too. You know, and the example you're talking about with like our stomach, you know, if you sort of look further back, you know, the very first genetically targeted medicines, like Gleevec, I think was one of them, was an anti-cancer drug. And it was supposed to be spectacularly perfect. It plugged right into the protein that would block the cancer that it was, or the disease that it was fighting against. And the scientists thought it would be perfect. And it worked for about 2 months or something like that. And it worked perfectly for about 2 months. And then the system changed. You know, the human system evolved quickly and it stopped working.
We don't know why we evolve in that way.
So the microbiome is the same. Like we can poke and pull and make one change, and we can eat more bananas and more greens, but there might be something else in our environment which changes it another way. So it's really hard to work in absolutes in a lot of these areas.
Well, they did a study where there was aggressive mice and mice that weren't aggressive, they're more docile, and they took the gut bacteria from the aggressive and put it in the more passive, and they took the passive gut bacteria and put it in the more aggressive, and they switched personalities.
And so like those are the kind of things that we don't understand, the interface between the microbiome and the brain, for example, or behavior manifestation. That being said, there are plenty of areas where it's really interesting and reachable in the very near future. Our genes and our environment combined can tell us a lot about what type of illnesses we're most susceptible to, what we should look out for, how to behave in ways that, based on probabilities, can make our lives longer or make us healthier and make us happier. And I think that that's much closer to being within reach because sequencing of human genomes is getting so cheap. I mean, I think we're down in the thousands of dollars. It's going to go to being a cup of coffee eventually, you know, $20, $10.
You can order it off the internet or something, or have exactly. Just print it out.
Right. And so when we get to that level, then those kinds of personalized recommendations, medicines that we know will work on some kinds of people but not other kinds of people, then those things become very real. And it's not going to be life-changing per se, but on the margins, it should make us healthier, happier, and make life easier. From a health standpoint.
So do you follow the telomeres, Bill Anders?
Yeah, I've been following, with the roundworms very often and the sort of the effect of telomeres on life.
Well, he just came on my show and announced last week that they actually have a full solution treatment for lengthening your telomeres back to a young cell level. And so whole treatment's very expensive, like over $1 million, and so they're charging like $2.1 million on their first treatment set because they're going to use that for research to find a much less expensive, because at that rate it's only for the wealthy, right? And he's not interested in that. He's wants to use it to find it for the average person. But they're doing at the end of this year, they're going to do a study on primates because it's so expensive. They're using it on the mouse lemur because it's the smallest primate in the world. They're going to do a full-blown study with this, and it's like $1,100 per lemur. And after that, they already have in the East, because we can't, you know, we have stricter rules here. They have already have 1,500, over 1,500 people signed up to do the first treatment. The world is changing. Yeah, you got to listen to that episode. I just had it last week.
I will go and dig into that. And that brings up another question. I know you got to go in a section, but in a second.
I got about 8 minutes.
But what happens when we live, if we do live to be 150? You know, are we ready for that? And if the telomeres change, does that change everything in our body?
Exactly. I mean, a lot of the things, you know, there's still cancer issues. There's still detox issues, you know, where you get junk in your cells and things. But when you get your cells down to back to being a 24-year-old, so many of those problems are going to go away because a lot of the problems are from mutations in your cells. That happens when your telomeres get shorter.
Yeah. To be honest, though, I'm always skeptical of these things because the systems, like we were talking about, are so complicated that it's hard just to fix one thing and think that there won't be implications or assume that it will fix everything.
Well, and they know.
And so I'm real curious as to what happens. I mean, I'm sure that there will be a big impact, but I want to kind of see this play out.
Absolutely. And that's, he says that too, because Aubrey de Grey, who's one of the leading, probably the leader in the world in this area, I think they've identified 7 areas of aging. And telomeres is one of them, but it's the low-hanging fruit. If you don't solve that, you can't solve aging, period, right? The other ones they think are easier to be solved, at least they thought, but now telomeres might be the first one to get solved. But yeah, how does everything interact? And just because you live to 140, now the other stuff is all messed up, and so maybe you can't live longer, and maybe there's another low-hanging fruit past that, you know, that you don't fix that, no, you won't go anywhere either.
Yeah, or do we actually have the, you know, the moral right?
There's all sorts of ethics.
Is that a good idea?
Well, yeah, now we have all these other issues, but do we have the moral right to let people suffer through the old age knowing that they don't have to suffer? There's a lot of ethical issues.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. And it's a more interesting time than probably ever has been in the last 30, 40 years, which is why we wrote this book.
It's an avalanche. We have an avalanche of stuff. I teach ethics at the University of Minnesota, the School of Business, Carlson School. And I love talking to you about this stuff because we're moving into the end of the semester and we're going to talk about technology. And so I'm just telling them, you know, we think that we have ethical issues now, but you as leaders going into the future, you guys are having an avalanche that's going to be hitting you. I mean, it's very seriously.
Oh, 100%. And actually, so in the book, there's an anecdote which Vivek did when he was out teaching. He asked a class, I think it was in Mexico, two questions. He said, would you approve of allowing parents to alter the genomes of their children if they have like a 60% probability of getting a bad form of childhood cancer? And everybody said yes. And he said, would you approve of allowing parents to alter their kids' genomes so that they're going to be taller and will be thinner and will have more parallel facial structures? And people said, well, that may not be such a good idea. That's not fair. And he said, basically, congratulations, they're the same thing.
Well, that's the ethical issues, and that's when we have to zoom out and say, okay, are we going to look at individual rights, or are we going to take more of a broad of, you know, utilitarianism, where you look at, you know, that's the founding fathers where they put that together, and they looked at it, and individual rights tended to win out, and then at that point, if individual rights wins out, then people get to choose what they want to do, but it's going to be hard, because if everybody chooses something that destroys ourselves, then that's not very smart.
Well, and I think there are questions that arise around this from inequality, because, I mean, as you're talking about with the telomeres research, so, you know, what if it turns out that these 1,500 people get it and then it's banned after that or something? I mean, who knows? I'm not saying that's going to happen, but then those 1,500 people, because they could pay a lot of money, they get an extra 50 years of life. Is that fair?
I know. And so there's all sorts of ramifications. Or if only the wealthy can get it, they can now, you know, because if you think about it, we don't live that long. And think of what you're learning now and where and what I'm learning now in the middle of my life. I have maybe another 30 years to really go. But if I had 80 years to go, what could I do? You know, and so the people that get that extra time, what are they gonna, how, are they gonna be able to do things that the rest of us can't? And they could, it's just, that's why it's important. That's why he says it's important that he has to do it for the whole mankind. He does, he's not interested in just the wealthy, but he's using it, you know, for, he's a scientist and he has really pure heart, but it's not those people we're worried about. It's the usages and how we end up from a society making those decisions.
And I totally get that. And that makes sense. At the same time, because these things are coming on faster, developing faster, you know, moving into the mainstream faster, you know, it will, I believe, constantly be an issue of, you know, how do we ensure equal access to the latest and the greatest when it is something that could give you 2, 5, 10 years more life, or make you happier and healthier, or make it easier for you to become an Olympic athlete. You know, we're already seeing in society this huge differentiation between the haves and the have-nots.
Exactly.
And I wouldn't say that that's technology driven at this point, but I could easily see that starting to happen in the future.
Yeah, I do too. Okay, so as we close this out, I want to talk about what scares you the most, and then we'll talk positive. What excites you the most about the future?
I'm actually kind of an optimist, so I mean, actually, what scares me the most is probably the same old stuff that scares people from before. More just conflict and the sort of the resurgence of nuclear weapons. You know, and sort of the problems that we have right now, which we didn't have before, you know, or at least for the last 20 years with other nations and in coordination. I mean, it looked like after the wall came down, we were heading towards an area where nuclear weapons were going to be far less of a big thing. And that's not true anymore. You know, and that's like the ultimate biological weapon, right? You know, so that I think that that sort of the speed of technology, you know, that scares me for like how, you know, a presidential tweet could cause something like that, or, you know, or a fake social account, you know, because not from a partisan standpoint one way or the other, just the fact that these things move so much faster, but the consequences of having so many nuclear weapons around is still the same.
Exactly. Okay, so what excites you the most?
Really the educational stuff, because I love learning. It makes me so happy to learn things. And the idea of a world where anyone can learn just about anything they want, really, I would feel like that would be a very rich and rewarding thing to have in the world.
Wouldn't it? Yes. Oh, gosh, that would be amazing.
And to be able to do it on your own terms and in ways that are faster and cheaper, you know, and would ultimately, I think, hopefully level us to a much greater degree, you know, so that we all would be better educated and potentially have a better chance, you know, at doing life we really want to do.
So where can people find your book and learn more about you?
I'm not actually that interesting, but
yes, you are. This was a very interesting conversation.
So the book, I would recommend you purchase it online at Amazon, or most of the major bookstores will probably carry it. We believe Barnes & Noble and a few other places. But it is called Driver in the Driverless Car, and you can order it from Amazon or any other fine online bookstore. We love them all. As for me, it sounds a little weird, but if you actually Google me, you'll learn a whole lot about me. My bio is also on the Mozilla website, it's mozilla.com. And use our browser too, Firefox. Quick plug there. It's the only independent browser. Sorry to do that to you.
No, that's okay. That's the whole point of this little end part is for you to give your plug.
Yeah, but just like you know, check the Mozilla the Mozilla bio, and if you're interested too, I have written a lot over the years. So if you sort of Google for me and start to plow through the things that I've done, either at Business Week when I was a journalist, or on Medium where I've written things, you'll probably find a lot of stuff that I've done. Hopefully you'll enjoy that too.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Alex. Thanks for joining the program.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. This was a pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, so did I. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Of course, I will have his contact information on my website at sarahwestall.com, and you can get all my past episodes there. I also have a YouTube channel now that you can subscribe to, or my newsletter. The YouTube channel is really taking off. So to help support the show, if you could subscribe to that and also like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter, that helps the show. It helps get the word out there about the show. If you can retweet things, if you can share stuff with people, I'd really appreciate it. It really helps get the word out. Also, if you have any suggestions on any kind of guest or person or topic that you would like me to cover, feel free to email me at sarahw at galexconsulting.com, and I will look into that. I'm always looking for great people to interview, so if you have a tip on somebody who really knows their stuff, cutting edge, how society is changing, disruption, innovation, and the big issues. People who've been following me a while probably see that I'm just really trying to cover the edge of change and trying to document what's going on. So anybody that has great insight on that, someone who's just an expert in their field, is what I'm looking for. And I want to remind you that you can get my show every day of the week. I'm on 90 plus podcast channels, streaming channels. I am no longer on WBLQ. If you are a listener from there, you should call them and tell them, why don't you add her back on? But the way radio works is they want you to pay a significant amount of money per hour that they run your show. And I don't believe that's right. I create a lot of content, and I believe my content takes a lot of time. I'm not selling a product as much as I'm bringing on really good information that I think the public needs, that you can't, or it's really hard to find elsewhere. So I think I'm doing a public service, or at least that's what I believe I'm doing. So for me to pay for my time and the amount that they're expecting doesn't make sense for me. I think that at least I should get time for free, or they should pay me for my content. So I just can't fathom that. So if you know any radio station that would also like to air my show, that would be great as well, where it can help bring in listeners for their show, they can sell advertisements, but I don't want to have to pay to broadcast my show and create all this content and then have to pay someone to air it. So if you know a radio show that would really like to air it, please help get the word out on that as well. I want to remind you to have an amazing weekend and rest of the day. And as we close out this episode, I'm going to play an anthem that is dedicated to all the people around the world that has fallen to these wars, these despicable wars that we have on an endless, ongoing basis.